corner and share the printer. This was when I had started having hallucinations because of the spray mount. Are you serious? The guys from Wired were upstairs. I remember Lewis coming down and showing me a mock-up of the sample issue they had put together to get funding. I definitely had a visceral reaction, the suspicion that some people within the tech culture, establishment people, had looked at Mondo 2000 and said, "Well, this won't do." Lewis Rossetto. All this time, we'd been trying to get in touch with Nicholas Negroponte. His secretary said he's going to speak at TED. He'll look forward to talking to you three. Richard Saul Werman. When I first did TED, every single conference was white guys in suits that were either politicians or CEOs sitting on a panel, or a guy who stood at a lectern and put down a speech and read it. Every conference was about one subject, siloed. TED was not siloed. It was about a convergence between disciplines. I had captured this audience at the convergence of technology, entertainment, and design. These two people came, the beautiful Jane Metcalf and the somewhat acerbic and very bright Lewis Rossetto, a handsome couple. They said, "We've found an audience for everything that we've been thinking about," and TED was their audience. TED was Wired, what they had in their minds. Jane Metcalf. The conference started at 8 a.m. I think we met with Negroponte at 7:30. He said looking at a business plan this early is like doing a shot of bourbon for breakfast. He flipped through it. Lewis Rossetto. The lights are down. Nicholas Negroponte sits there and looks at it page by page. He closes it and says, "I'm in." Nicholas Negroponte. I asked them, "How much money do you need?" They gave me a number and I said, "Fine." It was a handshake. Lewis Rossetto. It was like the sun came out and rainbows appeared. Nicholas Negroponte. And to protect my investment, I told them I wanted to write a column. Jane Metcalf. Oh my God, he's going to help us. And he's going to write a column and help us find more money. Lewis Rossetto. Warmth hit us in the face. He's the first guy who said, "I think it's a good idea, and I'm going to help with real support." It was like, finally, yes. Jane Metcalf. He was clearly on our side from that moment forward. It was phenomenal. He said, "Let's go find Bill." We ended up at some party that night, and Bill Gates was perched on the buffet table with his smeared glasses, swinging his legs back and forth the whole time. He turned through the magazine. Lewis Rossetto. He looked at me weirdly like, "I don't think this is going to do it." Sort of shrugged and gave it back to me. Coco Jones. I was at Mondo the day the check arrived from Negroponte. It was not an easy conversation when I later quit to go to work for Wired. They called me a traitor. Are you serious? They had gotten funding from a bunch of seriously well-known people in the tech cultural world, Nicholas Negroponte being one of them, and I had the distinct sense that these would be the sorts of people who would not like us and would be happy to see an alternative pop techno culture magazine come up, because it won't be so anarchic and druggy and somewhat disreputable. Coco Jones. Mondo hated Wired. They felt it was completely derivative of what they were doing. Gary Wolf. Mondo 2000 was the drug side of this culture. Wired was the other side. Jane Metcalf. The world was changing, and so everybody's seeing it from their own worldview. Some of them thought it was changing because we were all doing the same drugs. Other people thought it was changing because we were using the same digital tools. And so there were people who could surf in between those worlds, and so there were some common threads there in terms of contributors. Lewis Rossetto. At that point, we started to get serious about putting the band together. I was the editor-in-chief and also the publisher and CEO, so I knew that we needed somebody to keep the trains running on time, a managing editor. So I called Kevin. He came down to our office. He listened to this whole idea. Kevin Kelly. I was surprised. I thought I had successfully discouraged them from pursuing this idea, but they weren't giving up. Lewis had a prototype that had been funded by Negroponte, a color Xerox spiral-bound copy of articles that were taken from other sources and reimagined, recurated into this prototype. It was a magazine about the culture of technology rather than just technology itself. I had never seen anything like that. I said, "Oh my gosh, this is going to work." Louis Rossetto. I said, "So we need to hire a managing editor. Who would you recommend to do that?" Never thinking that I was offering him a job because I didn't think he was the guy. He was already editor-in-chief of his own magazine. Kevin Kelly. So the question I had for Lewis was, what's the budget? We paid almost nothing. Mondo 2000 paid almost nothing. Lewis mentioned a very adequate professional editorial budget. I said, "I think this is so good that I'll help you launch the first issue." Lewis Rossetto. And so we created a position for him which wasn't in the business plan. We had no money for it, but he became the executive editor of the magazine. And then we still needed a managing editor. John Battelle. I was going to move to New York to be a freelance writer. I wanted to start a magazine about the impact of digital technology on culture. My catchphrase was, "The Rolling Stone of the Digital Age." I was at a payphone picking up my voicemail, and there was a message from Lewis. I almost deleted it, which would have been the biggest mistake of my career. But I called him back. He explained what the magazine was, and that did it. I was completely hooked. Lewis Rossetto. John came up on Monday, and we were in the office at 2nd Street, and the place was completely deserted. There's nobody there because we hadn't really started yet. There was one chair and a sofa in this big empty place underneath the casement windows. John and I sat there and talked for a couple hours. By the end, I'd somehow convinced him that this is what he should be doing. So instead of him moving to New York, he ended up convincing his fiancée to quit her job. She was a producer at CBS News, and moved to San Francisco. So he became the managing editor, just a fucking demon, and she became our PR person. The two of them, in lots of ways, made the whole thing happen. Kevin Kelly. John Battelle was a key hire. He was right out of grad school with a lot of experience, tremendous drive, very organized. The one question I had was whether he was too square. He dressed preppy. This was a renegade outfit. Lewis was a born renegade. I was an old hippie. John didn't look like one, but it turned out he had an inner renegade in him. John Battelle. We all brought different networks to bear. I had been a trade reporter covering Apple and technology generally for 5 years. So I had those writers. Lewis knew fabulous freaks from all over the world. Crazy artists, hackers from Japan. Kevin had the Whole Earth Network. Stuart Brand and those guys. Fred Davis. Wired had writers just hovering, the cream of the crop. We were cheering them on, forcing them to produce this magazine, because we all wanted to write for it so badly. We were also frustrated writing reviews of printers. Lewis Rossetto. We had raised $250,000, but now we were paying salaries, rent, electricity, and all the stuff it takes to make a business. We were going to run out of money in 4 months. I wanted to make sure that when we ran out, if we weren't on press, at least we'd have a magazine we could take to a major publisher and say, "Take a flyer on this." Michelle Battelle. There were only 10 or 12 people working at Wired at the time. Amy Critchett was there, and Kristen Spence, Eugene Mosier. Amy Critchett. I was one of Wired's first interns. Jane Metcalf. Amy came in and wanted a job. And this was back when we had Kristen working for no money. And Eugene tapped to work for no money, and I said, "Sure, you can have a job, you can work 80 hours a week having the time of your life. The only problem is we're not going to pay you." She's like, "Great, that sounds great." Michelle Battelle. I couldn't believe that they were putting something together that didn't require a whole bank of desks. They barely had any supplies. Amy Critchett. Lewis was very clear in his thinking that if you bought people a bunch of pens, they would all disappear. So why buy them in the first place? Kristen Spence. We put the office together with spit and tape. I was responsible for furniture procurement. South of Market was a wasteland. Lewis and Jane were mystified that we didn't have an IKEA store nearby. We went to salvage yards where we got a bunch of crap-ass hollow-core doors and put them on top of old used filing cabinets or sawhorses for desks, completely ad hoc. Amy Critchett. There was no heat and certainly no air conditioning. It was a freezing cold winter. So at one point Lewis said, Amy, go rent a heater. And I rented this industrial heater. It was like a jet engine that literally had flames coming out of it. And we sat it on a mail cart. And it had this really loud kind of roar. And that was our heating system. Everyone wore cut-off gloves. It was freezing. It was a freezing winter. Jane Metcalf. We pushed it around to blow heat on people because it was cold and wet. People were getting sick. The water was literally coming through the roof. It's like, you can't get sick. You can't get sick. The magazine has to be at Macworld. Michelle Battelle. Wired was supposed to launch right around January 15th, 1993, because they were aiming for Macworld. Kristen Spence. That added to the whole vibe. It was a skunkworks operation in the extreme. We were so committed and passionate about what we were doing. We were living it 24/7. There would be times when we'd be working at 1 a.m. There would be a handful of us working. We'd be cranking house music because the rave scene was blowing up, and Eugene was deeply involved in it. The rave scene, the revolutionary aspect, we're guerrilla revolutionary journalists. Fred Davis. It was this pre-Burning Man, a non-salon survival research labs multimedia gulch group of artsy, nerdy people. Amy Critchett. We were just working so damn hard. And so every night had the potential of turning into a party. Nothing that scandalous. There was definitely drinking. There was definitely, I'm sure there was some coke. I'm sure, definitely, there was ecstasy around. After work, we were blowing off steam. Jane Metcalf. Everyone was sleeping with everyone at Wired. Lewis and I were sleeping together. John and Barbara, the magazine's graphic designers, were sleeping together. John and Michelle were sleeping together, and that only left a few people who, I'm sure, had found other people to sleep with, because we never left. Amy Critchett. There was a couple of couches in Jane and Lewis's office. Eugene basically lived there. Michelle Battelle. I was from a different world. I was from CBS Network News, where we still had to wear stockings with our skirts. We were much more buttoned up. Seeing Eugene emerge from one of the back offices where he had been sleeping was really interesting to me. It was the first time I'd seen a lip ring in my life. Kristen Spence. For those of us who were super young, it was just this cool thing happening. But Lewis, Kevin, and John Plunkett had the long view. They understood how much things were changing. Amy Critchett. Lewis was magnificent. His presence, force, and passion. That's what made Wired happen. John Perry Barlow. Jane had the real juice. She got people really excited. There were a lot of people that gave them meetings because of her. She had a lot to do with creating the energy in the magazine, and to a fairly strong extent, its attitude as well. Louis Rossetto. Battelle was the most focused, hardest-working manager I've ever met. He was intense, yet calm. The foundation on which the editorial team was built. The guy who got it done, no matter what. He could sit at his computer for hours on end, his fingers jabbing at his keyboard, like it was a karate exercise, just getting it done. Kevin Kelly. For the last week, Lewis came up with these kamikaze headbands. He wanted everybody to wear these headbands in solidarity or something. I never got the allusion. We were going to kill ourselves? Lewis Rossetto. The payoff was seeing the magazine come off the press. A big six-color Heidelberg roll press. And seeing for the first time what that means. The rolls of paper are up to my shoulders. I can't put my arms around half of them. And gargantuan big black barrels, 55-gallon drums, filled with screaming orange day-glow ink. rolls of paper the size of Volkswagens, and ink were buying by the barrelful. John Plunkett, it was a built-in contradiction. We were using an old medium to evoke a new medium that didn't quite exist yet. We knew it would be some sort of electronic networked future, but we didn't know what that would look like. How could we make it visible? Kevin Kelly. Color on the computer was no extra cost. Therefore, there should be an extravagant use of color, because it's free. Eugene Mosier. Adding fluorescent colors was a way to evoke the screen, transmissive color rather than reflective color. Fred Davis. You could use color on every page if you didn't have to pay for color separations. It was possible for Wired to have very low startup costs because they were done with desktop publishing. Louis Rossetto. Then we get on press. The first sheets come out. They rip them off the caddy, put it on this big table at the press control panel with the lights that are adjusted to get true color. The guy takes out his loupe and he makes some adjustments. Finally, he says, we're ready. John looks at the sheet and says, I want more ink. The guy says, it's perfect. This was a press that had never done a job before. Every piece was pristine. We were the first clients to go on this press. There wasn't anything that was sloppy or worn or out of adjustment. The guy says, this is the perfect first sheet. John Plunkett. What printers define as good is the least amount of ink that they can put down. Louis Rossetto. John says, I want more ink. The guy looks at him like he's got two heads. He does the same thing all over again. John says, more ink. They do this two or three more times. John says, all I want you to do is turn the ink up until it starts to smear. Then dial it back until it doesn't. That's what I want. The guy is disgusted. Out comes a sheet, and it looks like Wired. Eugene Mosier. More! That was the theme of the first issue in terms of getting it physically created. John Plunkett. The experience of picking up the magazine and flipping through those first pages was intended to be disorienting and disruptive. To take Marshall McLuhan's advice and make the medium be the message. Kevin Kelly. In the first issue, you have Bruce Sterling. You've got Stuart Brand. You've got Van der Loon.
I was basically taking the same subjects and the same people that I was talking about
and working with at Whole Earth, and I was doing it in Wired in color. But it was, like, totally different. Suddenly, the entire world was paying attention. Suddenly, it was like the most amazing thing in the world. Suddenly, it was like, oh, my gosh, this is revolutionary. Justin Hall. I remember seeing an advertisement on the side of a bus rolling by with Bruce Sterling's face cropped and day-glowed staring out toward me. Jane Metcalf. You can't believe how little we paid for that. Justin Hall. I was so excited to see a computer magazine with a human face on the cover. I thought, oh my God, like these people get it. Technology is about this culture that's happening. And I'm so excited that these people got it. Louis Rossetto. We weren't making a magazine about feeds and speeds. It was about the people, companies, and ideas making the digital revolution. Carl Stedman. There it was, this mix of business, technology, and culture. That was right. Wired got it. So I was entranced. I was both entranced and horrified, because it was clear that Wired was horribly awry when it came to its politics. I didn't know the term libertarianism back then. It hit me as very conservative. Louis Rossetto. I was at Columbia in 67, 68, 69, and 71. And of those 4 years in college, two of them were wiped out by eruptions in the spring.
It felt like the world was coming unglued.
And if you had eyes, you could tell that there were issues in society that weren't right. But the analysis from the left just seemed wrong. It was like refried Marxism and this colonial grievance bullshit, and that was so inauthentic, and their prescriptions, what they wanted to have happen, so wrong. So then I started looking for other stuff. And I think I'd read Ayn Rand. And then from there you realize there's more than objectivism. There's this libertarian strand, and then you realize that libertarianism is really deep. It goes back to Pierre-Joseph Proudhon and beyond, and has all sorts of other manifestations in American history. And I just got farther and farther into that and realized this is kind of a good way of thinking about things. Carl Stedman. Wired had this ideology that had no sense of social justice. Instead, it was social Darwinism. And I couldn't abide that because I knew Wired would succeed. It was clear that Wired was it. So that day I had it in my mind that I would have to go to Wired and change it from within. Justin Hall. My immediate reaction was, I want to join. I want to be a part of this. So I called and I left a voice message on Louis Rossetto's answering machine and I said, "Hi, I'm in Chicago and I'm connected to the hacker pirate underground of the bulletin board scene out here. I'd really love to write something for you or connect you with those people. Here's my phone number." Then the craziest thing happened. He didn't call me back. John Battelle. It was overwhelming, really overwhelming. All of a sudden we were a hot ticket. The company and the people behind it, the writers, photographers, illustrators, became rock stars. Fred Davis. Having Wired on your coffee table, man, that was a status symbol. That said, you're part of that digital visionary crowd. You're part of that cyber culture. Kevin Kelly. And every day there were cameras and TV companies sitting in our offices. And for me, it's like I'm doing exactly the same thing I've been doing for years at Whole Earth, with very few resources for a very small audience. Suddenly I was doing it on a big stage with colored lights at the center of the universe. It had been hard to get anyone to pay attention before, and now everyone was saying it was brilliant. It was peculiar but wonderful. And yeah, that was a surprise I was not expecting at all. Louis Rossetto. There's something about investing your humanity, your eccentricity, your exuberance in the things you do. That's what the first issue of Wired was about. It was about being naked with your craziness, your enthusiasm, your genius. It was pushing to be as great as you can. Be naked. Be human. Let people see who you are. Amy Critchett. One thing for me post-launch that was, just I'll never forget till the day I die, is all of a sudden I think, wait, do we have to make another magazine? And then again and again and again, like the idea that it was a monthly occurrence was beyond mind-boggling to me. But we did it. Louis Rossetto.
Jane and I had been sprinting flat out for 3 years to get out the first issue, and then the marathon began.
Jane Metcalf. We were exhausted. Everyone needed a vacation. Then we looked at each other and said, oh shit, we're late for the second issue. Toy Stories. From Park to Pixar. Technically speaking, Pixar is not a Silicon Valley company, as its headquarters have never been in the valley proper, but its roots lead directly back to Xerox PARC. Back in the 70s, Alvie Ray Smith was PARC's unofficial artist in residence. He'd come in at night to play with Dick Shoup's super paint machine and ponder the potential of computer graphics. Like so many others before him, Smith believed that the computer could be much more than a productivity tool or an entertainment device. It was a new kind of paintbrush and a new kind of art form. Xerox explicitly rejected that idea when they kicked Smith out of PARC in 1975 for being what Stuart Brand called a computer bum, a hacker, essentially. Smith turned his fall from grace into the start of a 20-year vision quest. The dream? To make the world's first full-length computer-animated film. The journey first took Smith to a research lab in Long Island, where he met his future partner in Pixar, the like-minded Ed Catmull. Then, in 1979, the two boomeranged back to the Bay Area where they found new patrons. The first was George Lucas, who was in the process of finishing The Empire Strikes Back. Smith and Catmull were the core of Lucasfilm's computer group, the proto-Pixar. Steve Jobs was their next patron. He took over from Lucas in 1986 after leaving Apple and set it up as a technology company which made little computer-animated shorts on the side. Ostensibly, Luxo Jr. and other early Pixar filmlets were created to showcase what could be done with Pixar technology. In reality, the technology was just a means to an end. Pixar limped along for almost a decade while Catmull and Smith waited for the inexorable advance of computer power to catch up with their movie-making ambitions.
The inevitable result? Toy Story.
Which, like the prior era's Pong, marks the emergence of a new American art form. Alvy Ray Smith. So when David DeFrancesco and I got booted out of Xerox, we had already cast our lots together for an NEA grant. And suddenly we didn't have the basic instrument, which was the frame buffer, the picture memory. Dick had the first one in the world, so we had to find the next one. We knew there was one was being built in Utah, so we went there, and they looked at us, a couple of hippie freaks. They said, "You know we're Department of Defense funded, but there was a rich guy who came through here and bought one of everything in sight, including the frame buffer." It turned out to be Alex Schur out on Long Island. Ed Catmull. He had this school funded by government money for Vietnam vets returning from Vietnam. Alvy Ray Smith. New York Tech, or the New York Institute of Technology, as they are very careful to say these days. Ed Catmull. And it was, at that time, not a particularly strong technical school, except that he was willing to fund this lab. We weren't really connected with the school, other than being on the same property. And then the equipment arrived, and we set up a computer room there and started programming. Then two more people showed up. This is Alvy Ray Smith and David DeFrancesco. So Alvy then became my third hire. Alvy Ray Smith. We got ourselves out there, and he snapped us up. He didn't snap David up, he snapped me up. David, again, didn't have a job. Ed Catmull. It was a while later before I even hired David. So we had this equipment, and Alex would come in every day because he was just so excited about it. He also had an animation studio. Alvy Ray Smith. So then Jim Clark shows up, and we hire him to build a head-mounted display for us, because we all thought it was such a cool idea, and he built the one at Utah. And so we wanted one of those. So he agreed to come, and Jim picked it up immediately that he wasn't going to last. Jim Clark. I was fired from NYIT, which led to my going to Stanford. Alvy Ray Smith. He went off under this cloud, which was unfair in our opinion, to build a geometry engine and start Silicon Graphics and all that. Butler Lampson. Jim Clark was at Xerox PARC as an intern. He was obviously a hotshot and had cool ideas about how to do graphics. Jim Clark. I saw the Alto. I saw bitmap graphics the same year that Steve came through. Steve Jobs said, "I am going to put this into a personal computer." And they made that little quaint box with the little tiny screen with bitmap graphics. I looked at the Alto and thought, "This is boring. It's just moving bits around. Why aren't they doing 3D graphics?" I left that summer with a project that I began to implement, which subsequently led to Silicon Graphics. And Ed was, at that very moment, in negotiations with George Lucas to be hired. Steve Jobs. Now, George Lucas, who produced the Star Wars film trilogy, was a smart guy, and at one point when he had a lot of money coming in from these films, he realized that he ought to start a technology group. Ralph Guggenheim. You have to understand, this was 79, so this was about a year or year and a half after the first Star Wars film came out, in the summer of 77. Everyone in the world thinks that George Lucas has got to be the most advanced, the most technological, superlative filmmaker ever. The visual effects in Star Wars were incredible. John Lasseter. When that movie started, you were swept away. By the end, I was just shaking. Ralph Guggenheim. That little computer-animated scene at the end with Luke shooting down the Death Star, it was astounding. Jim Clark, we all left New York Institute of Technology pretty much en masse. John Lasseter, Ed Catmull was hired in 1979 and asked to do three projects, with a fourth added by Ed. They were insane ideas at the time. Digital nonlinear film editing, digital sound editing, digital optical printing, and 3D computer animation, which is something that Ed brought with him. Ed Catmull, for the first year, I wasn't allowed to bring anybody. They'd only had one successful film, and they didn't want to overreach. Ralph Guggenheim, George didn't give Ed the go-ahead to hire anybody until Return of the Jedi came out in May of 1980, because if the film had opened poorly, he didn't want to be committed to spending a lot of money on a research group. Ed Catmull, finally, we were allowed to hire people, and so I brought in Alvy Ray Smith to head up the graphics group, and I brought in Andy Moorer to head up digital audio, and then Ralph Guggenheim from New York Tech to head up video editing. Andy Moorer built a digital audio processor, and then with Ralph, we built a digital editing system. Ralph Guggenheim. Just after Labor Day 1980, I show up at our office, which is not much of an office for a computer research group. It was in a renovated laundromat in San Anselmo that George Lucas owned. So here we are in this laundromat, and we're supposed to write these papers. The great irony is there's not a computer in sight anywhere in this building. Alvy Ray Smith. So we decided to build this machine for George. It was basically a supercomputer for images. Ed Catmull. The computer division was basically R&D. We were not part of Industrial Light and Magic. We had made some special effects. We did a minor special effect for the third Star Wars film, and then this major effect, which was for Star Trek II. Tom Porter. The Genesis effect for Star Trek II, that was a very technical piece of work. It was a bunch of camera movements. There were no characters walking around. There were no performances. There was no notion of character animation. John Lasseter. The computer animation world at the time was primarily in university research labs. It was mostly TV commercials, and mostly quite awful. Everything was made of stone and glass and very reflective and all that, because most of the stuff was being done by the people who created the software. And they loved mixing crazy imagery, and then putting computer music to it. Alvy Ray Smith. We decided we were going to show up at the next conference and show to the world that we did character animation. Not flying logos and not special effects, but character animation. That's what we wanted to do. Deliver the first character animation. Ed Catmull. We weren't interested in flying logos. We wanted to have characters and objects come to life. And this is where John is the master. John Lasseter. They brought me in to work on the very first 3D computer animation of a character. Alvy Ray Smith. And we knew what was going to happen. It was going to be an amazing event, and George Lucas was going to see it. John Lasseter. It was called The Adventures of Andre and Wally B. Alvy Ray Smith. The idea was that an android named Andre wakes up in this gorgeous landscape, and we knew we could do beautiful landscapes by then. And the sun is going to rise, and he's going to rise and stretch and welcome the new world of full character animation. It's a terrible story. It's really corny. John Lasseter. I was the very first traditionally trained animator in the world who worked with computer animation. And I just blossomed. I thought to myself, you know what? I can make an object move around and give it personality and emotion through pure movement. It was so exciting. Every day you would go to work and there would be something new on the monitor, on the screen. Wow, that's great. Alvy Ray Smith. John really saved my bacon. John Lasseter. Andre and Wally B was a massive step forward. It was very cartoony and people loved that. I remember one guy who worked with a computer graphics company coming up to me after a screening. to ask what software I used to get the humor in. Alvy Ray Smith. George hated it, and it just proved to him that we couldn't do animation. We were a bunch of techies. Also about that time, it was falling apart at Lucasfilm. George is chasing Linda Ronstadt around. Clearly, his wife had already left. And in fact, as soon as he got divorced, I went to Ed and said, you know, George never really got us. We've got 40 people here that we need to support. He doesn't have the money. He's lost half his fortune overnight. He can't afford us anymore. He's going to fire us. Ralph Guggenheim. The management at Lucasfilm kept coming in and saying, look, we are going to shut this down because George can't afford to spend more money on you research guys. Alvy Ray Smith. And one of the first questions to each other was, well, what are we going to do? I knew we couldn't do a movie. You know, I had just done the numbers. I had run them as tightly as I could, and I got the wrong answer. John Lasseter. Ed's dream, even though he was doing all this other stuff, was always to do a computer-animated feature film. Alvy Ray Smith. Everything was off by one crank of Moore's Law. Moore's Law being a factor of 10 every 5 years. We needed another order of magnitude. We needed another 5 years. We couldn't do a movie for 5 years. So what were we going to do for 5 years? We had a prototype called a Pixar Image Computer. Let's make a business out of that. Ed Catmull. I thought, okay, there is some basis for doing a Silicon Valley sort of startup. Alvy Ray Smith. Now this is two complete nerds saying this. We had no idea how to do a hardware manufacturing company. So we call up Jim Clark and he says, it's easy, but it will take you about a year to get it. Jim Clark. How do you tell a good friend, hey, you have got a shitty idea? I was not going to tell them that. Smith and Catmull had a prototype product, the Pixar Image Computer, and a plan that would allow them to spin out from Lucasfilm and continue on as an independent company. But they still needed a backer. The writing was on the wall at Lucasfilm. If they didn't find a funder quickly, Lucas would simply cut his losses and fire the entire group. They crossed their fingers and reached out to Alan Kay. Alan Kay. Alvy Ray called me up on the phone and said, we'd like to get out of here. Have you got any ideas? And I said, yeah, I do. I'll go over and talk to Steve. He was at Next then. Alvy Ray Smith. Alan Kay was the chief scientist at Apple before Steve got kicked out. Alan Kay. So I went over and talked to Steve, and then I guess the next week or 2 weeks later, Steve and I took a limo together up to San Rafael. And basically I spent a long time explaining to Steve just exactly who these people were. Alvy Ray Smith. Alan Kay brought Steve up to Lucasfilm to meet us. Alan Kay. They weren't like any of the people he had working for him at Apple. This was like the first team. These are like first-class people of extreme talents. Take a good long look at what they are doing and see what you think. And you know, don't fuck around with these guys. Ralph Guggenheim. Steve came up and saw what we were doing with the image computer and was very impressed. Steve Jobs. Apple had been doing stuff with graphics at some level for 10 years, but it was all 2D. The 3D stuff that Ed and his team were doing was way beyond what anybody else was doing. It was very exciting. Tom Porter. What Steve appreciated in us was that we were looking out 10 years. We had a clear goal, photorealistic imagery. Ralph Guggenheim. He was probably putting together ideas for his next machine, and he thought, it can't be a $100,000 box with 10 circuit boards like you guys have now. But if we can shrink it down to maybe one card in my new computer, this could be awesome. This could really give me a competitive edge over anyone else in graphics. And he understood the value of being able to do graphics. John Lasseter. Initially, it was pure software and computer hardware that he was interested in. Ralph Guggenheim. The animation thing? He had no interest whatsoever. Tom Porter. It wasn't reachable. It wasn't 2 or 3 years away. Ralph Guggenheim. The story I was told was that there was a conference call between Steve and the execs at Lucasfilm, and you can imagine execs in a conference room with a speakerphone on the middle, and Steve's on one end of the phone, and all of these execs are trying to negotiate with him at the other end. Steve says something like, I'll give you $5 million for the thing. I'm going to have to put in another $5 million. That's my offer. And one of the execs undoubtedly said, what? $5 million? That's not nearly enough. And I was told that Steve said, fine, go fuck yourself. And instead of going and fucking themselves, they took the offer and they closed the deal. George Lucas, we lost a ton of money on the computer division. Yet, thanks to Jobs's $10 million investment, the R&D group survived. It spun out from Lucasfilm to become an independent company, Pixar. John Lasseter, Pixar had two lives. For the first 10 years, it was more of a technology company. Tom Porter, at Pixar in those early days, there were 70 people. That grew to be 120 people. Ed Catmull, the Pixar image computer was the product when Pixar became a company. Tom Porter, they were trying to figure out how to sell this thing for medical imaging, for satellite imaging. Ralph Guggenheim, we were making short animated films on the side, in the service of selling the box, and in service of building the reputation of the company, and in service of our own secret mission to make a feature-length film using computer animation. Alvy Ray Smith, we sold a lot to three-letter agencies who did unknown things with them in D.C. and to Disney. Ralph Guggenheim, Disney were buying image computers to do their cell painting for them. Ed Catmull, CAPS is what they called it. Alvy Ray Smith, the problem was it was a bitch to program. The second problem was Moore's Law was going so fast in the background that by the time we got everything out to market, the standard computers, like a Sun or Silicon Graphic Workstation, were fast enough to do it. Tom Porter. Then Photoshop was written by the Knoll brothers, one of whom was at Industrial Light and Magic, who saw what the Pixar image computer could do and thought, this could be done on a Mac. Alvy Ray Smith. But for a short number of years in there, it was the fastest machine on the planet, but we didn't sell enough of them to carry the company. Ed Catmull. Steve didn't know anything about how to run our business, and neither did we. None of us had ever done this before, and because we didn't have venture capitalists involved, nobody knew how to find the right people. We didn't know what it meant to find a good sales or marketing person. We were all completely ignorant. And in a high-stakes game. So we had to learn a lot, and we made a bunch of mistakes. Alvy Ray Smith, we run out of money. We did it about 4 or 5 times. We should have been dead, and the other company would have shut the doors. Ed Catmull, I learned a lot, a great deal, and Steve learned a lot. Each of us were learning, and with all these mistakes, we came close to failing. Alvy Ray Smith. Steve could not withstand the embarrassment of failing on his first event out of Apple. He just couldn't. It was so embarrassing. So he would just write another check, and eventually he had put $50 million in. Ed Catmull. There were some really difficult times, and there were times that any one of us almost gave up. Alvy Ray Smith. Steve tried again and again to sell the company. I wrote the business plans. If anybody had come in and made him whole on the $50 million, he would have been out of there overnight. We should have gone broke. Ed Catmull. And there were times it was, okay, I can't believe this is happening. Ralph Guggenheim. Luxo Jr. was nominated for an Academy Award. John Lasseter. Our short film from 1986 called Luxo Jr., is only a couple minutes long, and we were so limited by the lack of computer power that we couldn't even give the characters a background. We just locked the camera down and had this wood floor that faded off to nothing. Tom Porter. I doubt Luxo Jr., an artistic piece, rang any bells for Steve Jobs. There wasn't any money in it. There wasn't computing in it. Frankly, Luxo Jr. is not very high in visual complexity. It was a nice badge of honor, no question. But that, in and of itself, wasn't the breakthrough. Ralph Guggenheim. The next year, Tin Toy won the Academy Award. Luxo Jr. and Tin Toy were huge hits, and a big success for everybody except our computer hardware sales guys. They were pissed. We were getting all this credit for our animation, but not for the hardware product. Even Steve was getting frustrated. Ed Catmull. So Beauty and the Beast came out in 1991 and used all the software that we had written for Caps, and it was an incredible success. 91 was also the year Terminator 2 came out, which also used our technology. So all of a sudden, the two big moneymakers of the year made heavy use of technology, and the whole industry just, like, yanked their head around. Holy cow. Something is changing here. Clive Thompson. It marked a very weird shift in filmmaking. When you shoot a regular movie, you shoot with a camera, and all you get is what the camera's eye sees. If you want to change things in post-production, all you can really do is work with what light hit the camera lens. The thing that was revolutionary about Pixar is they were essentially generating an entire world, a virtual world, where they can move the camera anywhere they want, because it's a virtual camera, which they can fly around anywhere they want. So they can shoot a scene and look at it, and then decide, hey, let's put the camera somewhere else. Thus, the camera becomes just another post-production element. That's a very jargony way of saying you create the scene, and then you figure out how you are going to look at it. That's revolutionary. That's complete inversion of the way Hollywood movies had worked. Andy Hertzfeld. But Steve came really close to going bust there in 1992 or 1993. Next and Pixar were failing at the same time. He was running out of money. He came pretty close to crashing because Next was on a dead-end path. And Pixar had a similar thing in that the technology wasn't quite there. Alvy Ray Smith. Life with Steve was awful. There was this famous board meeting at Next. Steve comes in and he's busting Ed and me for being late on a circuit board for the image computer, which we were. And I said, but Steve, you're late on one of your boards. Which was true. Now, normally, that would have just been okay. Not this time. He starts insulting me, making fun of my accent. Playground bully stuff. This was not two intelligent people having a conversation or even a healthy debate. This was just sheer bullying. And what did I do? I just stood up and went right into him. Now, I'm very proud of that. But it probably was an insane thing to do. I went right up into his face, screaming in rage. I still can't believe it happened. Just weird, just screaming at each other. And at that point, I forced my way past him and wrote on the whiteboard. I wished I'd written something clever. I was too insane. I just made a mark. It was a forbidden act, so he said, "You can't do that." And I said, "What? Write on the whiteboard?" That was it. He stormed out of the room. Ralph Guggenheim. Alvy and Steve, it was just oil and water. Alvy Ray Smith. A lot of people jumped to the conclusion I got fired, but Steve didn't have the right to fire me. Steve was the chairman of the board, so Ed would have had to fire me, and Ed wasn't about to fire me. And so, even though I was there for another year, I knew I had to get Steve Jobs out of my life, because he was a foul bully boy down underneath it all. So what happened in there is that Disney finally came. They knocked on the door just at the right crank of Moore's Law, and they said, "Let's make the movie that you guys always wanted to make. This is the big dream, right?" Ed Catmull. They thought that computer animation looked like it might have a future, but it was a boutique film. Those were their words, so they were willing to fund it at a very low level. Alvy Ray Smith. So we go off and make the movie. And by the way, I left right in there. What finally freed me up to leave was the movie happened. Tom Porter. Toy Story itself took shape in 1993 and 1994. Ralph Guggenheim. Toys were something we could easily render realistically on a computer, so it seemed like something practical we could do. Joss Whedon. They sent me the script and it was a shambles, but the story that Lasseter had come up with, the toys are alive and they conflict, the concept was gold. I went up to Pixar and stayed there and wrote for 4 months and completely overhauled the script before it got greenlit. Ralph Guggenheim. But the Disney execs kept pushing us to make these characters more edgy. We want them more hip, more edgy, more aggressive. John Lasseter. Edgy. That was the word that they kept using. We soon realized that this was not the movie that we wanted to make. The characters were so edgy that they had become unlikable. The characters were yelling, they were cynical, they were always making fun of everybody. Ralph Guggenheim. And so we ran into story problems along the way, mainly because it got to where Woody and Buzz were just horrible. And so we're now at like Thanksgiving of 93, and we show our latest story reels. John Lasseter. And the movie was just horrible. The characters, especially Woody, were just repellent. Woody was just awful, awful, awful. And I was embarrassed because it wasn't the movie we set out to make. Tom Porter. Disney actually went to shut down the production because they no longer believed that the story could work. And John and Andrew famously asked for 2 weeks. Ralph Guggenheim. John, Pete Docter, Andrew Stanton, and Joe Raft holed up in a room for a week or two and just rewrote the script. Joss Whedon came in again, too. Joss Whedon. We sort of went back in the trenches and made sure we had everything we needed and nothing we didn't. Ralph Guggenheim. And they rewrote the script, top to bottom. The script got approved. We resumed production. It could have been a total disaster. John Lasseter. From that point on, we trusted our instincts to make the movie we wanted to make. And that is when I started really giving our own people creative ownership over things, because I trusted their judgment more than the people at Disney. Alvy Ray Smith. So Steve's busy running Next, and Disney took the movie to New York, and the critics saw it. They went nuts, and they said, this is going to be a huge success. And as soon as Steve heard that, he pushes Ed aside to be there when the cameras roll. Ralph Guggenheim. You can see the light bulb go off in Steve's head. This thing that he's not really been much a part of. Alvy Ray Smith. He didn't have anything to do with it. Never had anything to do with any movies. In fact, they never let him in a story room. Ralph Guggenheim. I would say between 86 and 95, when Toy Story came out, Steve probably, I'm not exaggerating, I don't think he was in our building more than 9 times in 9 years. Alvy Ray Smith. So Ed and I, the way we ran the company was to keep Steve out of the building because he would come in and give one of his speeches, and it would take us a week or two to get it all back together again. Ralph Guggenheim. Steve was a very generous benefactor, but kind of an absentee landlord all this time. Within a couple of months, we have a new CFO who knows how to take companies public. Steve is now going to be the CEO of Pixar, etc., etc. Alvy Ray Smith. It was when I looked at the prospectus for the IPO when I first realized that Steve lies. He claimed to be the co-founder of Pixar and the CEO since its founding. In the prospectus, co-founder and CEO forever. Bullshit.
Both of those are wrong. Lies.
I don't like this reality distortion field idea. He lies. But you know, his genius was to take the company public on nothing. The movie wasn't even a hit yet, and there was essentially no cash at all. But he saw his chance to make his $50 million back, and he did. Alan Kay. Steve just hung in there and hung in there until they got into the sweet spot, where everything that they knew suddenly was applicable in a way that made commercial sense. Al Alcorn. Steve thought he was going to make a computer, and he wound up making one of the best movie companies in the world. Who would have thought? Jobs timed the Pixar public offering to take place exactly 1 week after Toy Story's theatrical premiere, thereby ensuring that the value of Pixar's public offering would be pegged to Toy Story's box office. It was a bold bet on synergy, and Jobs hit the trifecta. His movie was the highest-grossing film of 1995. His IPO was a blockbuster, and his reputation was restored. Alvy Raysmith. Steve made $1 billion overnight. It may have made him a billionaire for the first time. So business-wise, the guy was a genius, and he got everything he deserved on that front. Alan Kay. I remember feeling extremely good when I saw that Pixar had become such a success, because any funder like that should be rewarded. 10 years. That was an incredible thing. Ed Catmull. It was the biggest IPO of the year. It was bigger than Netscape. It was an incredible thing.
Jerry Garcia's last words. Netscape opened at what? The Internet is almost as old as Silicon Valley itself. But before the browser was invented, the Valley took the net for granted. There were online experiments like the Well, but for most, the Internet was simply the ether that carried email hither and thither. In the 80s and early 90s, the conventional wisdom was that the real action online was inside the great walled gardens of AOL, CompuServe, and Prodigy. The World Wide Web was a latecomer that floated on top of the already existing Internet, providing an open-source alternative. Yet at the time, few in the Valley took the web very seriously at all, if they had even heard of its existence. It was little more than an academic curiosity until Jim Clark, a Silicon Valley hardware mogul who had made a fortune selling specialized computer graphics machines to Pixar and others, decided that the conventional wisdom was wrong. He founded Netscape in 1994, and in just over a year the company laid the foundation for virtually every technology that defines today's online experience. Alan Kay. A lot of people think the Internet appeared in the 90s. It started in 1969. John Markoff. Today's Internet started with the ARPANET, and the ARPANET started with two nodes, and one of them was in Southern California, and the other one was at Menlo Park in Doug Engelbart's Augment project. Doug Engelbart. Bob Taylor and Larry Roberts, the two guys running that office, told us all that they were going to go ahead and put together this network, and I volunteered to start a network information center, and that's sort of why they put me on early. John Markoff. The NLS system was supposed to be the first killer app for ARPANET, which became the Internet. Bob Taylor. But the ARPANET was not an Internet. An Internet is two or more interactive networks. The first Internet was put together by Park. They put together three. The Ethernet, which they invented, with the ARPANET, with the SRI Packet Radio Net. That was in about 1975 or 1976. We had an Internet without a World Wide Web or a browser. Those things we did not invent. The first version of the World Wide Web was hacked together in 1990 by Tim Berners-Lee, an English computer scientist working in a French physics lab. The embryonic web was a geeky but efficient way to link a couple thousand physicists to a tiny number of supercomputers. Then Mark Andreessen, an American student working at NCSA, the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois, built NCSA Mosaic, the first decent web browser. Steven Johnson. You can't imagine how hard it was just to get on the Internet in like 1991 or 1992. It was a colossal battle. You knew that there was this incredible thing out there, but it was just really difficult to get to.